Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening. October 26, 2006, and a tremendous amount of material tonight, so I will be talking at a rapid pace. First of all, I want to remind you that there's a bunch of imposters running around the internet claiming to have been associates with Velikovsky. And I'm in regular communication with a guy named Warner Sizemore, who was Velikovsky's daily assistant throughout about a 30-year period. And I can guarantee you that the groups that call them, for example, themselves leaders of a group called Electric Universe, copying my work on a daily basis, have little, if any, association with Velikovsky. Some of them were part of a group. It's kind of a ragtag group, but a lot of claims there not well-founded by the main ringleaders of that particular group. It's unfortunate that many of the old Velikovsky people try and hang on to that group. They would be much better off splitting away and doing their own research and not having the stigma of being associated with the nutcases that really did a lot of damage to Velikovsky. So once again, buyer beware when you're on the internet dealing with Velikovsky, a lot of people trying to make claims of association where there were none. At any rate, by the way, Warner Sizemore, I have a very good interview with him on my 2005 radio show. I believe it is at the end of the year. You can look in my archives for that. Also, it's on the 2005 MP3 radio CD that's available on my webpage. But at any rate, on to the show, a number of major topics here. First of all, a major announcement. Something is brewing here. I keep mentioning that I have a major announcement coming. We're just doing the background work to make sure everything is in place for its release. But stay tuned. Some major announcement is about to unfold, and it'll be made public here shortly, probably very widely on many radio shows and through other sources. So just stay tuned. It's something that has been, the researchers have been looking for this for thousands of years, and I've cracked the nut, let's put it that way. So, very interesting. Stay tuned for that. It will be coming out very shortly, as soon as we get all of the pieces in place for its proper release to the public. Tonight, I'm going to talk about a couple of topics, the main topics, and I'm going to get right into them. Put yourself, can you imagine what it's like being a scientist today, either a Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, or Tier 4 scientist? What it's like to go through training, get your degree, and then go on to whatever profession you would go into. But I want to define that, talk about that, so people out there have an idea of what these scientists are like, what their background is like, what their lives are like, who they are, what makes them tick. Because it's very important as you move into the topic, which is the main topic for tonight, as we, as a species, as the human race tries to grapple our way into space, what are the mistakes that have already been made? What are the mistakes that will cause ultimate failure? They're already in the works. They're not even in the planning stage. They're already implemented, guaranteeing the failure of the human race in outer space. So, but to understand this, you have to understand that the scientists are the core of this because they're the ones that do the work. They're the soldiers of the elite. Let's put it that way. So you can tell where I'm going to go with that one. But it's going to be very interesting to fill in the blanks. And by the way, I get a chuckle. I have people who listen to all the radio shows around the planet and report back, so I know what's going on. And the general theme of a lot of people is that there's really nothing going on today. But it's times like this when there's really not a lot going on in the news, when typically a lot is going on in the background, and that's why people listen to this show, because I can dig into that background when there's no real news on the schmooze news or on the talk show hosts that don't really have information or background to look into these real details. I can look into these and find out what's really going on and let you know. So that's part of what's going to be going on tonight in the main theme of this show. First, a couple quick announcements. This is actually old news, but I want to reiterate that in the Temple 1 Deep Impact flyby and impact of Comet Temple 1, they found olivine. Now, olivine is a glass. It's actually a green glass. It's found in various places in the world. One of the great deposits is in the South Pacific Islands near volcanic breaches. And anyway, it's a short-lived element or molecule, whatever. Can come in a crystalline or amorphous state. It's a glass. And basically, they found this kind of material in the outgassing of Comet Temple 1 when the impactor hit on July 4th, 2005. And of course, I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show with other guests talking about it that particular night. But we didn't find out about the olivine till a number of months later. Actually, about a couple months later, it was finally released in September of 2005. But how does a volcanic glass get into a dirty snowball? Gee, I wonder how that could happen. At any rate, on to another topic. This week, scientists at the Western United States Region National Center for Atmospheric Research announced that there would be climate extremes are coming, the study says. And at any rate, of course, I've been saying this for years, but of course, this study, which is the Schmooze News government version, says that it will be due to global warming. But of course, that's not the case at all. But they need their standard story in place so that as these climate changes do occur, as, let's say, objects come into the solar system and change our solar activity, and as the sun acts up, as it should not be doing according to standard space science theory or astrophysical theory, of course, they say that the sun is constant over billions of years, based on the core fusion model of the sun, which obviously is not correct. The fusion of the sun is up in the surface of the sun, so it can change rapidly and it can interact with objects coming in, comets moving by it, etc., or even alignments of the planets, electrical alignments. So at any rate, the Schmooze News government story that climate extremes are coming, but it's due to global warming, that buzzword that gets a lot of people, a lot of scientists have made a living for their entire career off that little incorrect buzzword. Now, here's something. This month, there was just a rash of information coming out of the Cassini probe, which is, of course, going around Saturn at this time. First of all, they have now looked down into the atmosphere of Saturn with infrared. They can see through the haze cloud tops and see tremendous detail activity, storm activity, swirling bands, counter-rotating bands of gases up in the upper atmosphere. And also they're seeing an incredible amount of heat coming out of Saturn. And, of course, they don't know where this is coming from. So the dynamics, the scientists have to figure out why this is so active. And, of course, I talked about this in my 1981 paper called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted, published in the Moon and the Planets, an astrophysics journal, peer-reviewed journal. And clearly, Saturn has ongoing fusion in its atmosphere. But that's not the topic of tonight's talk. But just interesting that all of a sudden there was a rash of news releases in the past week. A new ring being discovered around Saturn and being associated with two of the small moons. And now also talking about Uranus, our next planet out. It turns out that they have found a new dark spot, kind of like the Jupiter's red spot or the many other spots that we see on Saturn. Uranus now has its very own spot in its ringed atmosphere, the atmosphere being much less active than the other planets. But obviously, these current patterns, these wind current patterns in the atmosphere being electrical in origin, just like our own jet patterns in our jet streams in our own atmosphere are electrical. But these planets are farther out. They have a little bit of different dynamics with the solar wind and their electrical discharges of the solar capacitor. A new note here. This is extremely interesting. Mars, it was announced that the new Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that went into action this past month is giving extremely high-resolution photographs. And I always like when they tell you how much they can see. They could see a chair-sized object on Mars. Let me tell you, I guarantee you, they could see an ant walking around on that planet with these optics, the optics in these satellites, but they're not going to talk about that or give that type of resolution to you. But at any rate, satellite is 180 miles above the surface of Mars taking pictures, and the end result, which is amazing. Now, you will remember that, even within the last year, atmospheric scientists that deal with Mars, planetary geologists, etc., were saying that, well, there were traces of water on Mars, but it was due to something billions of years ago, that B word, that Carl Sagan B word. But these scientists are saying that first of all, there was the formations that they're seeing, the geological formations they're seeing, were formed over a number of events. In other words, it just wasn't one. Now, how could that happen on a planet that's out in the middle of the solar system away from everything else? And then they said water flowed in this area, and it was geologically recent. In other words, something happened, and they put an upper limit of 100,000 years, but that means it also could have happened 4,000 years ago. Isn't that right? And it says the water dates from the current geological age. In other words, the time we're living in now is the current geological age. Whatever happened to Mars and the deep cuts, the deep ravines, the watersheds, layers of ice and dirt that were moved, etc., happened in the current geological age with an upper limit of 100,000 years ago. Now, how exactly? That means that Mars had an atmosphere. That means what? Mars had oceans, rain, extreme water activity, and geological change due to this water within the last 100,000 years. Now, that is a major announcement, but you don't see these scientists really talking about how this changes our view of the solar system. What exactly caused this? 100,000 years ago, we have a very good geological record of what happened on Earth. So how did Mars, our next neighbor out in the solar system, have all of this incredible geological change and losing its water, losing its atmosphere that held the water in place? They don't talk about this. They're very mum about that topic, but the wall is breaking down. Just a quick notice here. Over the past months, there's been a number of attempts by the disinformation crew to associate my name, try and damage my good name, by having nutcases, obviously plant nutcases, using my name either in public speeches or at astronomical events. And what they'll do is they'll get up and act as complete nuts, which they are, and then use my name, throw my name around, Velikovsky's name around, and all kinds of other numerology, goofy stuff, and the idea is to associate my name with nutcases in public places. So I'm just letting you know that that's a ploy that's going on. It's incredible the amount of effort the disinformation crew is spending on trying to ruin my good name, support websites that are trying to steal my material and make it crazy, etc. I'm not going to go into that, but just if you do see this going on, a lot of the times these are in professional meetings, so the public doesn't have access to them. But the idea is to try and smear my name. It takes a lot of effort on the part of the disinformation crew to keep active. They must be real worried about something I'm saying and the accomplishments that I have and my ability to get directly to the public. We're going to get into the main topics tonight, right now. This past week, interestingly enough, announcement came out regarding the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, and I have a huge posting on my webpage. If you happen to listen to this show during an archive and after the date of the show, you can go to my Thought of the Day page, and all of my postings that occur on the top of the page are always archived there, so you can go back in time. And these are the October 22nd to 25th 2006 postings. I'll leave them on the front of my webpage, dealing with a number of issues. All of a sudden, NASA announces, and under the very kind of surreptitious and quiet title, that they are looking for galaxies in the universe, something that most people would not look at or pay much attention to. But the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, the WISE satellite, will be launched now in 2009. Originally, it was scheduled for launch in 2008. And I have talked about this satellite in the past. This is the one where they can go up and see very faint clouds of nebular clouds that surround objects out in the far reaches of our solar system. And they know that that's what you have to look for if you're looking for a Planet X-type object. And literally, none of the Earth-based infrared telescopes, as good as they are, as sensitive as they are, can see these objects because you're looking through atmospheric moisture, water haze in our atmosphere. And this is even for the telescopes that are on mountaintops, the very good infrared telescopes. And what you're looking for is an extremely faint water cloud or nitrogen cloud out there. And they're very difficult to see, they're very cold, and they're blocking the solar light, which is very faint out there at those far reaches of the solar system, hitting an object. Here's what happens when objects come into our solar, donut nebula, or the nebular ion cloud, as I call it. I have a couple different pseudonyms that I use for that construction out there, where the solar wind holds back a positively charged nebular ion cloud. Is very faint. We can see these around other stars. But anyway, as an object from the distance comes into our solar system and enters that region, it discharges the capacitor, draws in a very large, very faint cloud, but it hides the object. So the only way you can see these objects is with extremely sensitive infrared cameras, which have the ability to see wide fields of view, and in a perspective from Earth, they might be as big as the sun in the sky. That's how big these clouds could be out there, but they're extremely faint, so you need very special equipment to see this. So that's what this satellite is all about, under the guise of looking for distant galaxies far away in the universe. But at any rate, listen to some of these quotes. Approximately two-thirds of nearby stars are too cool to be detected with visible light. A WISE satellite will see them all. These are quotes out of the news release coming from, to give it a reference, physorg.com, dealing with, and then it says, listen to this quote, "This mission is incredible, has incredible power for discovery. I expect that what we will find will be amazing. There is still so much we don't know." That's an interesting statement coming from a NASA scientist. And now listen to this. Such extensive sky coverage means that the mission will find and catalog all sorts of celestial eccentrics, including perhaps elusive brown dwarfs close to Earth. Goes on and says they can be detected best in the infrared, but even within the infrared are very difficult to detect. Gee, who's been talking about that recently? Here's another quote. Brown dwarfs are lurking all around us, but they haven't been found, but we haven't found them because they are faint. So NASA, number one, is admitting that there isn't one Planet X-type object out there. There are thousands of them. They are admitting that they must be out there in large numbers, but they haven't found them. So basically, number one, NASA is announcing that it has an all-out search to look for Planet X-type objects. Number two, it's admitting that it doesn't know anything about them. And, you know, while you have goofy Tier 3 scientists running around criticizing me for talking about Planet X, while you have the nutcase government plant disinformation people pretending to talk to aliens and clouding up the entire topic of Planet X, while you have all of this background government disinformation going on, all of a sudden NASA comes out and it says they are going out to look for these objects by the thousands. And they put in charge of this program none other than Mather, the guy who just won the Nobel Prize for searching for remnants of the Big Bang. So isn't that a prestigious position for our new lofty Nobel Prize winner, which, by the way, was totally political, in my opinion, that because the Big Bang is in no way confirmed, what these guys are seeing with the COBE satellite and the other the cosmic background radiation satellites, the microwave detectors, what they're actually seeing is the heat remnant from the nebular ion cloud that surrounds our sun. And I've told them many times in public, in private, that until they get outside of that region, about three times the distance to Pluto, and make their measurements for microwave background radiation, they will look out and they're not going to see this universal microwave background radiation all over the universe. But they wouldn't put that in there. I loved in the explanation of the Nobel Prize, they said nobody else could explain this data. Well, gee, they didn't let anybody in the journals. They edited out and by peer review prevented anybody else who had another opinion from getting a word in edgewise. So, at any rate, very political 2006 Nobel Prize, and I've talked about that before, but lo and behold, they take the winner, one of the winners of the Nobel Prize, and put him on this project to search for Planet X. Gee, NASA, you're starting to wake up. And at the same time, at the South Pole, the South Pole Telescope is under construction, and very interesting that they want that built by fall of 2006. How do you get 244 tons of telescope down to the South Pole in a four-month period and build it? And so a lot of questions there. I put a posting of an email I got from a friend of mine who's very familiar with government contracts and what you should expect in a government contract. I'm just going to quickly read this email on the air, not quoting anybody's name, but this was a private communication to me from a person who's extremely familiar with government contracts, has worked in the government, around the government, and supported government projects in the past throughout his lifetime, very experienced. So here's what his comment was about the South Pole Telescope and the webpage and the information being released to the public. He said, let's see now, parallel programs just in case one gets behind schedule or has a failure. The University of California website is one of the most incomplete major science project sites I have ever seen. The list of subjects not detailed would run two pages. Would love to see their budget, schedule, etc. Could not even find a link to the prime contractor's brag site. This puppy is a whopper. that the budget is well north of $150 million. No mention of the support facilities to be built at the South Pole, or are they just going to kick out the science teams currently in residence? No brag pages on how they overcame the engineering challenges of placing 244 tons on ice and maintaining stability. Understand, there was even the manufacture of backup components in Europe. I've never seen an NSF, a National Science Foundation program, move this fast with such invisibility, especially for a telescope. How many telescopes of this size have ever been assembled in 3 months, let alone at the South Pole? None. Operational by South Pole fall. Know anyone? He's just asking me then, do you know anybody at any of the support universities? And then he says, I bet the data flow goes through a three-letter agency before anybody else sees it. The end of email, but very interesting things going on. And this is what I'm saying. Behind the scenes, I'm able to, and the friends that I deal with, my long-term associates that are able to peer through what's going on, a lot of times it's what's not being said that you have to read into and understand and interpret, and that's why people listen to this show, because you get news you are not going to find or hear anywhere else. While the other news talk shows are saying there's nothing going on, actually, there's a ton of stuff going on. You just have to know how to find it and what to look for, how to interpret it. Okay, so on to, this is the lead-in to the main topic I want to talk about tonight, which is dealing, first of all, I want to outline what it's like to be either a Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 scientist, because you have to understand this to understand how the government and the, not really the government, because our government is really a facade, and that you have to understand also. The government is a facade for the World Bank, New World Order, people who've really been running this country since, for at least 100 years now, probably longer, since they got their hooks in, converted our monetary system over to the Fed, which, by the way, is a branch of the World Bank. Most people don't understand that. I talked to a guy the other day, and we were talking about this, and he goes, you mean our money is not United States money, and our banks are not our own banks? And I said, no, they haven't been for at least 100 years. You know, the Fed is a branch of the World Bank. Congress gave authority of our money to this group of European bankers, and we haven't had our own money since. It's debt money. It's phony money. It has no backing, and it's hedge money. It's the money that requires the United States to go out and continually have wars of conquest for resources, because and the other half of that is to support our military. Most people don't understand the immense amount of resources going into the military, and now into aerospace. Ever since Reagan and Star Wars, there has been an unseen aerospace military industrial complex eating up immense resources with great profit going into the pockets of CEOs of those corporations. And I've talked about that before. But tonight I want to talk about how the scientists are conned into being prostitutes for this huge organization, and how 99% of them are locked into it, and how people like myself, I'm probably what I call myself, the last of the independent scientists who actually worked on the inside. And now, when I broke away back in the 1981, it was very clear to me that I wanted no part of what I saw. And I've run my own businesses throughout these decades, seeing many times the inside workings of the military-industrial complex, and a lot that goes on. And that's through that. Those contacts and those business contacts, that's when I saw the operation, for example, the Bush-Clinton operations back in the 80s, when those guys were business partners a lot of people don't understand that. But I got to see this firsthand because of my contacts through the aerospace industry. Anyway, that's not the point of tonight's show, but it's instrumental in understanding that these people have been working in the background all along. So when you see, for example, the Bush-Clinton contingency operating and telling Space Satellite Command in Colorado Springs through their new their Vice President Cheney to operate a Katrina-type disaster for New Orleans, a lot of people don't put all those pieces together. And you have to understand all of this. I've got people get mad at me and say, well, Bush is a very honest man and Clinton is a very honest man, whether they're Democrat or Republican. You hear this banter. And how can you say this about these people? Well, most people have never seen the background of these people and how they are simply the representatives of more invisible people that run the European banking community. And it's not just the banking community. These people operate a lot of just the high order stuff that's going on around the world. For example, just a little example, the Bushes are very active in South America right now, gaining water rights, large scale water rights. Bush Sr., instrumental in a Canadian firm that is about to build a gigantic dam and water facility between the Chilean and Argentinian border, while George Jr. and his contingency are down in Paraguay buying up vast amounts of land which control probably the majority of water for northeast of the northeastern section of all of South America. These people are very busy behind the scenes. They're not just, oh, doing this and that. And that's why I say when you don't see anything going on in the major news media, there's tons of things going on in the background. But anyway, this past week, the Bush White House set out its space priority, defense priority. And very interesting, it was rather a unilateral statement that the United States will protect all of its interests in outer space. It was basically a unilateral claim that the United States owns outer space and no one else can go there without their permission. A very bizarre statement for a country who cannot get a mouse into space. Very bizarre for a country that cannot prove that it ever went to the moon. And even if it did go to the moon, has abandoned any claim to it a long time ago. How can you claim, make a claim to outer space using simply military hardware? We already have military hardware in space, and it has been used as a weapon of mass destruction. These are the large laser satellites that control weather. They've been used to create Katrina, Rita, the four hurricanes that devastated Florida the year before. We've seen these satellites in action. I've talked about this. So the United States already has weapons of mass destruction in space, and they are using them. So to think that somehow, someday, the United States may put offensive weapons in space is ridiculous because they've already been there for many years. So right now, they're just making public statements, and it's amazing that the people who are in think tanks and following this, the Centers for Nonproliferation in Space, etc., the people that watch this worldwide, are so behind the times. It is amazing that they have no clue what the U.S. presence and military presence in space already is. And of course, this is the old protection racket that they're saying that we have to protect U.S. interests of private industry going into outer space. But then you have the FAA, on the other hand, which is preventing many private agencies from going into space unless you buy into the economic program of the World Bank. In other words, you got to be a buddy of the guys in the front office of the FAA, of NASA, etc. So you find a lot of the spin-off companies that are doing work today actually have a man in Washington. And that's, in other words, you have to be part of the system. So anyway, with this in mind, I want to talk about, first of all, the Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 scientists, and kind of let you have a little insight into who they are, where they got their education, and what their life is like. And I'm going to start with Tier 4. This would be, say, the high school teacher and a person who teaches out of a textbook, a science book, something like that, or works in a low-level industry making components or that type of thing, maybe an engineer with a Bachelor of Science degree, works in an industry job. They go through college, they're bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and they get their degree, they go out and they get a job, and somebody pays them, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a year, or whatever the teachers make these days, probably under that, for sure. But anyway, they are taught something. The teachers in the classroom have to follow a syllabus and follow a textbook. They're not at freedom to, say, play a tape of my radio show in their classroom. If they did, they would be fired. If they talked about something out of my books, they would be fired. They have to be very cautious and follow a syllabus, because some parent might come around and say, "You're teaching my child terrible things, and I'm going to sue the school district, because I know my attorney can make a lot of money for me if I sue the school district and that teacher said something that little Joey or little Jeannie heard in class and it wasn't in the syllabus." So anyway, for that reason and for a lot of other reasons, they can't say anything. Most states have a law that says that textbooks cannot contain any material that is not verified to be true. What a bizarre statement for education. In other words, you can't say anything, and this is the big fight, for example, in Texas over creationism versus evolution, because the evolutionists say, well, it's proven that evolution works, so you can't teach creationism. So you get into this fight over these things where the vast majority in the textbook industries in Texas actually hired large numbers of professional PhD scientists to all sign a petition saying that they all agree that evolution is 100% true and there's no other alternative. Yet, they all claim that there was a Big Bang. Now, where's the evolution in the Big Bang? That seems like a godlike initial event of some kind out of nothing. But at any rate, be that as it may, despite the contradictions and all of the hoopla, the Tier 4 scientist teaching in a high school or working in an industry job, which with a bachelor's or master's degree possibly, is very limited, very compartmentalized, very structured in what he can do and say. Tier 3 scientists would typically be a step up, possibly a college teacher at a junior college. These would be, for example, outreach. Some of these people might have PhDs. They might be in an outreach program for NASA, where NASA, behind the scenes, pays them to fly around the country, go into high schools, and pretend like they're independent scientists just for the love of science, and they're going to help your kids, get a love for NASA. And what, of course, that does is it allows the teachers to be in these programs, get benefits, get pay raises, and get some kudos, some titles and some things like prizes and awards for working on NASA, and it makes the colleges and or the high schools feel good. So these outreach people basically are paid political entities of NASA to promote the NASA agenda to high schools, and what better program? Because then the kids go home and tell their parents, and they go, gee, what a swell outfit NASA is. And NASA realized a long time ago that it needs public PR, and that's the cheapest way to do it, is to get these flunky Tier 3 guys to run around the country and do it. And you know a few of those, and I know a few of those, and basically we call them textbook repeaters. They're guys that have gotten their PhD because they could repeat back what they read in a textbook. And so that would typically be the Tier 3 guy, the guy that will repeat the standard phraseology of what's going on in outer space and go around and promote the NASA agenda for a pittance, a small amount of money. And of course, he gets an ego boost out of it because all the kids think he's really a smart guy because he's got a PhD and he works, you know, he knows guys at NASA. Anyway, let's go up to Tier 2 scientists. And Tier 2 scientists are what you typically would think are the top scientists at NASA. These are the guys you'll see their name in newspaper, magazine articles. They're quoted in the paper. Mather is a good example of a Tier 2 scientist who's won lots of awards. If you look at his string of awards, you get this long list. So the Tier 2 scientists are the scientists that either at Los Alamos or Goddard or JPL, and they've worked up, they've got their PhD, they did their postdoc, they got a job at NASA, which is kind of hard to do. You have to be pretty good in your field to do that, to get your hands on this great equipment that we've paid for, and then go out and publish. And, you know, these are the guys that actually publish. The Tier 3 guys rarely, if ever, publish, or rarely, if ever, get their hands on real equipment. They really don't do any research, so to speak. So the Tier 2 guys are guys that are doing daily, that's research is their life, not teaching. You know, and they're not necessarily textbook repeaters, but generally they are totally out of the loop of what's really going on the planet in terms of science. I would say, in general, they are following the company role that's given to them. Very compartmentalized. If they're a planet surface geologist, that's all they work in. That's all they ever will work in, and that's all they will ever be able to talk about or publish about or get grants for. Very compartmentalized. And the beauty of that in the overall system is that nobody can object about what anybody else is doing. This idea that peer review occurs is only within your little group of people, of peers, and nobody's going to say anything bad about each other because they're all on the payroll. So anyway, that's the typical Tier 2 scientist. Flies around to meetings, they have a very nice lifestyle, they make a very good salary, and a lot of them make a good deal of money, probably two or three times their salary in money, doing consulting. For example, if I'm a Boeing or a Lockheed Martin, I might call up Joe Schmo over at JPL and say, you know, I need an opinion on this, and you ask him a question about a certain type of molecule. He goes out and spends a day, calls you back. He charges you 2-3 days of consulting fees and maybe a few thousand dollars, which is pretty good pay for just probably writing an email that he probably knew most of the information in the first place. So anyway, a lot of these guys will make $200,000-$300,000 a year in consulting fees. This is all invisible money that flows around the aerospace industry. And these guys in Tier 3, by virtue of the fact they work for JPL, they work for NASA, it looks good on an internal report, you know, Dr. So-and-so, JPL, gave us this information, all the paperwork looks in order, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's the Tier 3 guy. They fly around the world, they get their name in lights, they're at a lot of the meetings, they can fly to Kyoto, Japan 1 week, and they can be in northern Scandinavia the next week, they go to Paris the next week, then they're in South Africa for the next week at some conference reunion, whatever, and then they can fly around. They'll go to San Francisco, then Dallas, then they'll go off to Johns Hopkins for a weekend. And so these guys are flying all over and having lunch and visiting, and of course with all of these trips, I call them scientific vacations that you pay for. They get outings and free lunch, and it's quite a good deal. So that's the Tier 3 guy. And you got to understand, he's not going to rock the boat at all, because his gig is a pretty nice one, pretty cushy, and he's got a retirement at the end of that after 20 years. And after that, he can come in and be a lifetime scientist on the payroll and keep up, you know, make a pretty good living and not do much, still fly around, etc. So now let's look at the Tier 1 scientists. Okay, now this is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. The Tier 2 scientists in general have no clue that there's an entire layer of science above them. The guys that come in, now let me say something, there's a few people that come out of standard colleges, universities, get up, get good enough, are smart enough, really know their stuff, and one day someone comes up to them, probably somebody they've been working with for a long time, excuse me, an older guy, comes up to him and says, you know, Corey or Terry or whoever they might be, you're doing pretty good here. And we got a special assignment for you, but it's a bit of top secret and it's got some military attachments to it, so it's we need to give you a clearance here. And so the guys go, oh, I'm pretty important. So he gets his assignment, he goes out and does the job, and they watch him like a hawk. Everything he does, comes back, he presents his material, and they say, now you can't talk about this at any of your meetings that you go to, any of your regular work. This cannot come out. And so, oh, okay. So all of a sudden, he's got a classified piece of his brain. Then they give him another assignment. All of a sudden, he starts getting more assignments, and he starts becoming very egocentric in that he's very important. And he starts being brought up into the world of Tier 1 while still somewhat working with the Tier 2 people. And eventually, some of these people are simply plucked out and sent off, and they work on their own. But the majority of Tier 1 scientists actually are educated through military processes, through the schools like the Naval Academy, etc. And these guys take physics, they take their graduate work, they mix amongst the regular classes sometimes at regular universities, but they are trained in the military style of science. And it's all top secret, it's black ops, and you never see these people or hear their names. This is Tier 1 science. Okay, so now you have to understand that when you see NASA and it talks about what it's doing, or the Mars rover, or the Cassini mission, in that there are the Tier 1 scientists who see the data first. If anything comes out of that that they don't want the public to know about, it's the Tier 2 scientists don't know about it either. And the Tier 2 scientists typically get much lower resolution on photographs, on data. A lot of times there are experiments, say on Cassini, that the Tier 2 scientists don't even know about. So at any rate, or let's take Galileo, the big satellite that was around Jupiter. They said they crashed it into Jupiter. My opinion, and I can pretty much take this to the bank, is that they took Galileo, flipped it around some of the moons, and sent it out into the southern solar system to go out and start meeting some of these entourage of Planet X type objects coming into the solar system. That's where Galileo is, and that's Tier 1 science, and you will never see it. But I'll tell you about it on this show so that you know what's going on in the background. Okay, now, here comes, I just want to read this. It's a little short write-up I wrote, and this is mainly attributed to Tier 2 scientists. I say that there are four new elements that have been discovered by scientists. Number one is dolarium, and of course with the reference to dollar. Number two is publicium. Number three is honorarium. And number four is standard therium. And now the properties of these elements, they weigh heavily on the scientists' minds. They're central to all government-supported research. They're heavier than gold and silver combined, and without them, no government-supported science can proceed. There's a long list of awards, the honorarium, and credentials that are bestowed upon the scientists who discover these elements. And when fused together, these elements form an insurmountable monopoly for scientists that buy into the program and have sold their souls to the government-supported science program. They make their living feeding off the government trough. The biggest truth that scientists have learned from these four new elements, dolarium, publicium, honorarium, and standard therium, is that if they join forces and all say the same thing, that is, the scientists all say the same thing, in other words, standard therium, they can form an inseparable bond that cannot be broken no matter how great the opposing forces. So a little tongue-in-cheek there, dealing with Tier 2 science. But at any rate, on to the Bush announcement. Now you have to remember that when Bush announces and they say that they're going to protect private industry going into space, that's really the first public announcement that they already have military presence in outer space. Usually, public announcements are preceded by 5 to 10 years of actual activity in this area. So, in other words, NASA, the black ops backside of NASA, by the way, let's talk about budget just to put things into perspective. NASA's budget, annual budget right now, is running around $17 billion, that's with a B, and a lot of that money, we don't know where it goes to. Most of that money goes into black ops science. But there is about 100 times that spent in black ops aerospace science today per year. And just for an example, there was a $60 billion line item a couple of years ago. What was it, 2003? There was a $60 billion line item for naval aerospace procurement. That was hardware procurement. That was just one line item in the national defense budget. So NASA's $17 billion budget would be just a fraction of that. So you can see that there's a huge amount of black money going off into aerospace these days. So when Bush announces that, or Clinton or anybody else that's president, they all operate out of the same system. When any of these people announce something like, we're going to put a defensive military posture in space, number one, it's already been there for 10 years. They've already been building on it for 10 years. This is just the first inkling they're going to give out to the public, because probably foreign entities like China are going to start complaining. China already is. Russia already is. But number two, they're going to tell you that you can't go into space without their permission. So programs that can develop a private space program are going to need permission to go into space. In other words, they are claiming all of outer space. For the people, now you have to understand who's really doing this. It's not Bush in the United States government. He simply is the U.S. representative of the World Bank and the guys who have been running the show here for the last 100 years anyway, operating out of Europe. The guys, you never hear their name. You may hear Rockefeller, Rothschilds, names like that. But remember, they have this little trick of printing phony money and tricking you into thinking that it's worth something and to use it. They trick you into thinking that when you vote, you live in a democracy. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The engineers are basically the unsung heroes, but very poorly paid, what I call prostitutes of science, the same as with government scientists. In other words, these people are fully owned and operated by government science. Everything they do is owned. They sign a contract that's a non-disclosure agreement. They cannot talk about anything without permission from NASA or in all of the corporations that have NASA contracts have contracts with those corporations governing all the employees of those corporations. Now, ask yourself, why does Jim McCanney, why do I stay independent? Why have I always been independent? Why have I never signed a contract with NASA or the government? Why have I stayed independent? Because I will not sell myself, as these other scientists do, for a pittance and sell my ingenuity, my originality, and my material to be owned by these people. And that's why at a breakneck pace, they are attempting to steal my material. Every American Geophysical Union meeting, every NASA meeting, every NASA journal, every independent journal today is trying at a very rapid pace to implement and publish under the name of other people all of the material in my books, all the material of my papers, all the material of my original papers. You'll find that there are scientists in NASA who took the entire idea of Saturn sweeper moons and then tried to republish it. There's a guy who made an entire career out of my idea dealing with Saturn sweeper moons. So the idea that there is peer review or sanctity in peer review journals is garbage. This is a way for the people in charge to own and control scientists and everything they do. Now, I just have a couple minutes left, so I want to talk about going into space. And the inability of the public right now, or the human race, really to go into space. We are not psychologically ready, we're not mentally ready, and the biggest problem is that the military going into space as the front runner is a huge mistake. Because, number one, if we spend all our resources putting military hardware into space and military resources, all funded and maintained from Earth, we simply don't have enough resources to do this. It's going to break us, and it is breaking us right now. A lot of people are trying to figure out where all the money's gone. Over $1.7 trillion missing from the Clinton budget. Many trillions of dollars missing from the Bush budget. Where's all this money going? Well, it's going into outer space. And a lot of people in these industries know that this money is being used to prepare certain elite people for the coming of something like Planet X. Now, when you look at this announcement that NASA came out this past week, fully announcing that it has a search for not one Planet X item out there, object, but not hundreds, but thousands of them. They're talking about these things being all over the place, so they must have already discovered some to make the estimate that there are thousands of them. Only 1% of the sky has been examined to a high level of accuracy that the WISE satellite would portray or discover. So they know that these things are out there. They know that some of them have the ability to come into our solar system, and that some could even come into the inner solar system and affect planet Earth. So what are they doing? They are building a private space program with all of the resources of the world. They are garnering and harboring the water resources of the world. These people are very busy behind the scenes. So when somebody tells you there's no news, there's nothing going on, believe me, nothing could be farther from the truth. A lot is going on. A lot is going on behind the scenes. And in fact, the world is being taken and put in the back pocket of a very few people. The biggest resource that we are going to come on in the next 10 years is water. Now, as you know, I sell a water filter, the Berkey water filter. I'm not going to talk about it right now other than call the 800 number. Water is going to be the most precious commodity in the upcoming years. As part of my effort to inform you and get you ready for this, call the 800 number, 800-983-5622. That's all I'm going to say about that. Or go to my webpage. But water is going to be far more precious than oil or any other commodity or resource. And if you don't have the ability to get your own basic daily need of water, you are going to be out in the cold. As far as going into outer space, private space programs are the only way we're going to go into space. You have to go far enough, fast enough, to get away from the natural disasters that Mother Nature would impinge on any society. And sending the military out is a gigantic anchor around the society's ankle. It will not allow us to go far enough, fast enough, to avoid the major celestial catastrophe that Mother Nature can throw at us. Very simply put, the military is the downfall of the human race going into space. And also, if you go out there, there's an old expression, don't take a knife to a gunfight. That's what they're trying to do. At any rate, I am out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.